Thanks for listening to Psychedelic Parenting. If you like what you hear, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to our work through the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies or by using our Amazon link to buy the things you need. Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. With me today is Tara Celeste. Tara and I shared seats at a panel on cannabis at the recent Exploring Psychedelics conference in Ashland. And she had some very interesting things to say about education, drug education, and about the legalization of cannabis. I'm very happy to have her on. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Sure. This is our third attempt now here recording, and hopefully everything will work out just fine.
Yeah, all in its own time.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your life and career?
Sure. Okay. So I work in nonprofit finance, and I travel and I write, and that's what I do mostly professionally. Some of my writing goes into a little bit of website content, and I do some site curation as well for some of people's social media presence. I don't know what you call that. One friend said it was a neocultural online site curation, something like that. So I'm like, okay.
So famous people that don't want to use Facebook but need a Facebook presence, that sort of thing?
Or even people who they definitely need a Facebook presence. They've been kind of told that there's value to it. They believe in that. And that's usually the point when they find someone like me who's online kind of anyway. Mm-hmm. And then we go into sort of who they are, what it is that they want to communicate, what the theme of the page is. And then I look around and find my sort of, I guess, interpretation of the closest fit to what I think that is for what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll give some feedback too, like, you know, it's a good story, or I don't like sites that have like the Insta massive pop up in your face. As soon mm-hmm. as you get on their site, you don't read a story. You just see a bunch of, blah, 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 you know, mm-hmm. Oh yeah. So that's a little bit of what I'm doing on the day to day. And volunteer wise, I've done some event production type work. I've worked with organizations to help groups of people who are united around the same passion mm-hmm. come together. So let's say that you have a vision of an art project or some kind of garden that you want to build, something that really is unified. Like the group is like, yeah, we all see this. We've got the plan. We know we want to do it. And I have worked with some really cool groups in that regard and just come in and kind of figured out where I could turn the wheel a little bit and help those groups coalesce in their mission, you know, to the point that I was able to. So that's a little bit of event organizing. That's including like from forming a board of directors, mm-hmm. helping people find consultants, people they want to, you know, work with on like something very paperworky, you know, doing LLCs, that kind of stuff a little bit too, mm-hmm. or at least considering the question. Down to just like having a drill in my hand and being like, you mean right here in this spot? You want me to drill this right here? Okay. How far? 2 inches? All right. You know, like you want it to go all the way to the other side? You mean this side? You know, where I'm helping them build their project and they're giving me like, yeah, now do that exact same thing. Like glue this wood together just like that 200 times, you know, like see you later.
So I think you should mention that in our earlier recording where that didn't work properly, you were mentioning that you have been fairly well involved in Burning Man, both in terms of the event in the desert and also in the Utah Burning Man community.
I've been volunteering for different parts of that group since 2008. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess formally, I guess, in one capacity, I work as a regional or volunteer as a regional representative in Utah. I'm now alumni with that group, which mm-hmm. means that I'm around, available for contact. Certainly open to conversations, kind of advisory, mm-hmm. I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. I was really involved in some of the production from 2008 to 2011. And I also have since 2008 camped and been part of the volunteer ticketing technician crew with the box office. Mm-hmm. And so that's amazing because every year, no matter what's going on, I'm meeting people from all over the place who are coming to Burning Man. And to me, it's a very kind of a world-centric event, mm-hmm. full of a lot of diversity and interesting expression. And people mm-hmm. can come out and just kind of, you know, there is some conversation about skin, but you can really shed it out there and just be what you are. And, you know, in the end, the dust makes us all the same color, as they say. So it's a really beautiful spot and a very transitional space, which I dig. I really enjoy transitional energy, moving around the space between transitioning again, you know, that is something that I enjoy. So maybe that's also part of how I get into a festival that's all around building something beautiful, something that you really, really love, and then coming to a place of letting go with that and seeing this one central event of release mm-hmm. and openness.
Yeah, Burning Man has a very lot in common with like a Tibetan sand mandala. It's just this like massive work of art and creativity, and then in the end, it's just. Whew.
Yeah, I completely love that about it.
So do you take your kids with you to Burning Man?
I haven't. Actually, I talk with them about it quite a bit. And I have taken them to smaller campouts mm-hmm. and they tend to get sort of upset. And I found at one point where I had two kids in a car, both saying, "When are we leaving?"
Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, my only response to that was like, "Oh, like now, you know, like I'll just finish packing and we'll go." You know, I talked to them a little bit, but I just wanted to let them know that they weren't, you know, I wasn't going to push them past their level of engagement, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. And that was something that they didn't care for, like loud thumping music, which is great because yeah. for me, I'm like, park me right behind the speakers and I'll be fine, you know? And they were like headaches and tears. Like it was just, they can't sleep and it's, you know, they didn't care for it. Mm-hmm. As they're getting older, because now they're teens, one's an older, one's a younger teen, but they are both in the teen gap. And they are talking to me now about what they might actually like to do in terms of how to engage with that, what kind of music they like, what sort of campouts their friends have talked about. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of them inviting me to be mom on the scene and go with them. Yeah. And so, and we've had really candid conversations as they're growing up about things like as my daughter was going into junior high and, I was talking to her about, you know, so how's junior high? What's going on there? Cause I know what my junior high experience was like.
Terrifying.
I know. Well, yeah. And my elementary school experience, like, you know, this, like you have kids forming their own sense of identity and alliance and purpose. And some of that, even from a young age, is in comparison, at least, with the adults, you know, parental influences in your life. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about when she was getting into junior high, I was like, "Do you know what pot is?" And she's like, "Yes." And I was like, "Oh, how do you know that?" And she said, "Well, there are kids at my school who smoke it." And I was like, "Oh, you're a kid at your school. Do you smoke it?" You know, like. Okay, so I know what pot is too. Can we talk about this? Mm-hmm. And she said, "Well, they really don't do well in class. They're joking around. They're upsetting the teacher." And I said, "Okay, I wonder if that's every kid who smokes pot." And she says, "Well, they're the ones who smell like it during the daytime."
Ah, yes.
And, yeah. And, you know, they're the ones who obviously just went and smoked and then came back to class and they're playing out that, like, this is fun. We're learning through this other filter about other things, maybe not quite what's on the teacher's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her if, you know, if it made her comfortable. She's like, "No, definitely not. I don't want to have anything to do with them." And, you know, that was kind of like, okay, well, you know, there's other ways to look at this. And some people, including grownups, are definitely working with this in a way that is not so adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just kind of had a conversation about how if she ever was more curious or thought that it might be something she would like to try, that I would like for her to talk with me about that as well, if not first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, for me as a parent, I feel as though that is a very direct way of saying, this door is open to you. I'm not going to lose my mind. I'm going to talk to you about the responsible use. I think that part of what opens me up to this dialogue is the fact that I am living at a time when legalization is happening.
Yeah.
And there are places I can point to that say it's okay, perhaps here. Mm-hmm. You know, so while I can look at it and say, okay, you're young for this experience and other people around you are having it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your mom's view, is you're too young for this. But I certainly don't think that I'm keeping it out of your hands. I know I'm keeping it out of your hands. I haven't given you this,
mm-hmm.
Which causes me to say, but I know if it's inside your reach that someone else could.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would prefer that you, and then I just basically left it at all the time, whatever is going on, like, because kids and life and we all have those moments when we're young and, you know, we have to make discretional decisions. And some kids tell their parents everything and some kids don't. And some parents tell their kids everything and some parents don't. And, you know, all these different relationships come into play. And it's just finding, I think, comfort zone and then meeting your kids on their ground.
Mm-hmm.
Like how at this point they... I have two kids and they both seem pretty, I feel pretty open to this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always kind of, you know, I mean, I always wonder about the parents who didn't know what their kids were doing. And I'm always looking at myself saying, is it me? You know,
mm-hmm.
I open the door. I think, you know, I try to say like, it's okay. Talk with me. It's okay. I love you. This is what I want, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I have to also say both of my kids have told me that sometimes they feel introverted. My parenting partner is a self-proclaimed introvert.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've also told me that I have to not pry sometimes as much as I do with the talk to me, tell me I want to know. And I, okay, you know, I hear you. I respect you.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I want you to hear me too, that this door is open and it's important to me that you feel safe and that if something is going on and you need help that you ask and know that I'm here for you to ask, mm-hmm. you know, that's my prohibition framework too, coming up right there, you know, where I'm like, okay, problems, talk to me if you have issues, tell me if, you know, abuse, addiction, like that dialogue is what I was raised on, in this topic. And it's something that, I kind of feel comes up and I'm like, no, that's not actually the only thing or the only message I want to have with my children about this. And I feel like, you know, partly since the conversation begins with somehow some kids in some classroom, and this is such a scenario that we can all picture that it's like not even a non-part of our narrative, you know, like this is just like we all know those kids who were like, what's going on with those guys? You know, why is this guy fascinated with the bubbles in the washroom? Like, what's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a learning state, I mean, maybe you're curious. So it's okay for kids to like, be like, I'm curious about that. What is that?
Mm-hmm.
In my way, I guess, how I'm looking at this and I guess in my situation or my perspective, but, and that's kind of more what I'm trying to tell them is like, yeah, I expect you to be questioning and curious. And I even want you to know that someday it might even be like more kind of culturally safe or open or okay for you to be curious like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, like you could find yourself in a state where it's legal and you can even have people who have been working with it for a long time who can talk with you about their experience of what it is.
Right.
And, you know, you can look at different measures. This is a spiritual experience. This is a scientific measured experience. You know, here's a cultural experience. And anyway, so
can I ask you How long have you been working with cannabis?
Well, I was 21 when someone first was like, it's not anything that they've told you, you know? They're like, so I was 21, and my friends were in college, and I was sort of auditing college classes. So we were kind of in college and started getting stoned sometimes. And, you know, then you kind of find out some of the kids who've been doing this since like elementary school, junior high, high school. But I jumped on the train somewhere around college, but definitely when I was 21. And it was something that for me was a very, I think, cerebral space to explore. Mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time, hours and hours, just chilling with these friends, talking about physics, philosophy, engineering, social sciences, what was in language that day. Like, we just all sat and chilled in this room and had an awesome, awesome bong and just talked and talked and talked. And then we'd go watch like Star Trek or X-Files or something and crash, you know? And the next day, it was like 96, 97, 98.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So it was great. And then I took a nice long hiatus and stopped smoking altogether for a number of years. And I'm trying to think, how long would that have been? It would have been like 99 through 2001 for a break. And then I picked up a little bit for a second and then took another break from 2002 through about 2007. And even then I became very occasional. Just basically, I still enjoy cannabis or pot, marijuana, weed. I still, you know, I do. I think it's, for me, I think it's a healthy use. Mm-hmm. And I find that it's very relaxing. My friends would kind of joke, the ones who knew me, pre-pot and post, that the pre-pot me was like so extremely, linear. And I would freak out about things. Like if you were 5 minutes late, you know, I'd be about to have like a fit. And if, you know, this is like when I was in high school, and if you were 10 minutes late, I would like this, the earth would be opening beneath me. Like, you know, like it's the end of the world and the sky is raining hell and brimstone. And you know, post pot, I just kind of was like, okay. So things happen, you know, and it's okay. Like being on time is still something that in my world is very important at times. Mm-hmm. But being able to let go of that and kind of adjust myself socially, given the context, is something that I think cannabis has helped me out with quite a bit. Just in a practical sense, just like looking at it practically, like, could I have let go of someone being late or myself being late prior? No. And do my social cues kind of indicate that this is one of the things that was key in that change? And I think yes. Like, I think my friends would agree.
So how does that impact your parenting style?
Well, I think at this point right now, if I am feeling high and I'm around my kids, I still am aware enough of like the time, you know, that it's 7 o'clock or whatever else is happening with us and what their needs are. If they need to do their homework, if they are working out book report, you know, need to finish their math homework. And even to the point of if I'm not directly with them, if I'm out and about, if I'm traveling and writing as I do, then I still have enough going on, you know, in terms of like my connection and groundedness with this world that I'm checking in and like saying, you know, hey, it's Sunday night. Have you finished that work, you know, that you need to do for tomorrow? If I need to supervise them that much and really, for the most part, I do a little bit with the younger one, but the older one is, she's pretty well got it handled, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's not just about homework. I think that's on my mind because it's the end of the school year and it's like all the news,
sure. Yeah.
You know, right now. But it's also about, are they getting enough one-on-one time? And, you know, if anything interferes with that, it's probably the fact that I'm on my computer like all the time. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's something where are they getting FaceTime? Like I have to consciously like lock my computer in a box with several combinations.
No, but like my phone.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we have time too. And we just all sit on the computer and hang out since they're doing all this junior high, high school type work, and I have, you know, life going on. So mm-hmm. that's one of the things I kind of mandated was that as a family, we spend computer time together. Like, we can all stare at our screens, but we're going to do it in the same room.
Uh-huh.
You know? And we also, I think we bond a little bit through television. That's just kind of the nature of how it works in our family, mm-hmm. you know, with parents and grandparents and so on. But
I have to give you some props here, because many people in the psychedelic community would never admit that they watch television.
it's an occasional thing. Like, I have, you know, I dip into these TV watching worlds and then I get into it. Mm-hmm. But I also spent 6 weeks in a tent last year, you know, consecutively, and then spent a couple of days hopping between hot springs, and then spent another like 4 weeks in a tent.
So what you're saying is like, fuck you, I've earned my TV time.
I love a good story.
Yeah, me too.
I really dig storytelling, and I move around a lot, so I find myself kind of dipping in, and sometimes I get into the story, and mm-hmm. yeah. I'm grateful for it. I love it. People write like crazy, make stuff, act out things, do it.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I love it.
So why don't you tell us the stuff regarding drug education that you covered in Ashland? Because I thought that was some pretty interesting stuff.
Thanks. Yeah. It's an invitation to a dialogue. And what I'm looking at is in 2014, I was in Oregon, and as I said, I've been following the legalization of marijuana or cannabis throughout the Western United States. And so in Oregon in 2014, I was there at a time when they were just looking at recreational legalization on the ballot. And it's very active time at the polls, if, you know, as those things go locally. And they had lots of information available, like mm-hmm. What is 91? Like, what is it going to mean? Where does the funding go?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is interesting. And it was specifically about recreational, because mm-hmm. they were already working with the medicinal plan. I had been in Seattle prior to that, kind of coincidentally, the day after recreational legalization took effect.
Mm-hmm.
And, I gave it a week because they ran out like right away. they did.
Of course they did.
Yeah. And I was in the area to go camping anyway. So I went and did my camping and came back and had a day or two when I could just kind of, you know, transition out of camping into where I was going. I thought, well, I'm in the area. I'm going to go check it out again. So the quick story on Seattle is that I was smokeless. I went to the recreational spot that had been listed on Leafly. I double checked on the state's website to make sure that the license they'd been issued for recreational sales was listed there too. And it was, which meant they had like paid the fees and done all the applications. And there were a couple applications mm-hmm. for the license and also to sell and all this kind of stuff. And still, when I went to this location that was listed as open and selling, they said they were strictly medicinal. They were not in favor of how the recreational plan was being enacted in Seattle.
Mm.
And they spoke to kind of the reason why there was only one dispensary that opened on the first day of recreational sales was because it was a stance of the entire local market to say that they weren't in favor of exactly how this had been written out and enacted.
Interesting.
And yeah. And then you can find that article that I wrote on that on Reality Sandwich,
mm-hmm.
Smokeless in Seattle, and it's by Tara Celeste. And so then I was in Oregon as this vote was happening, so just prior to that. And I was there when it passed. And I was like, oh, cool. But it didn't go into effect for like a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so during that year, I was traveling and writing and doing my other contracts. And you know, then I was watching the news and kind of how it was going out. And it seemed like more like people in Oregon were saying, yeah, we like this. But there's also some kind of here and there, there's some vagaries that were left in.
Mm-hmm.
So they have, for example, taken edibles off the plate recreationally. And that's something that's like, they're just kind of having a fine tuning conversation about the difference and the meaning of medicinal recreational. And that's something that's happening quite a bit right now. And, you know, so part of my point here is to fill in the narrative between prohibition and legalization.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this prohibition culture that we've been working with for a couple of decades. And
yeah, it's, more than a couple of decades, right? Like the 1930s or something.
Yeah. Okay, and a long time. I found a children's book that my parents used to read to me that was from, it was published in 1945. And it was about this train that goes off the rails and goes frolicking in the buttercups and wears a daisy chain on its head and is just like, life is super grand. I love being off the rails. This grass is really soft, you know? But the book ends with the train getting back on the rails and straightening out. And then everyone, and the way that that happens is that every single person in the community waves a red flag at the train and guides it back to the rails. And that's kind of, and it's like, okay, from now on, it's just me and these rails. But you know, it was kind of maybe one of the first stories of what that was about, you know, one of the first stories of, an experience that is outside of what is maybe expected or the everyday, you know, and some of our society's reaction to it, you know, which may have been these red flags in the air saying like, whoa, you know, we're over here.
Mm-hmm.
And so this narrative of prohibition is something that has some development. There is a point in the narrative where people say, actually, you know, the train that, or, you know, it's kind of hard when you say train because of how they function. But anyway, you know, going into the buttercups has long-term health benefits. Like going into the buttercups might be good for you if you're a rabbit or, you know, like, just the option, starts to have different implications. Or even when you get into the medicinal side, which is one that, you know, as I look at the legalization question in Utah, or in a lot of places, and even how it's happened in our nation, to go medicinal first is to have a conversation that mm-hmm. says, what is your intent? What are you using this for? Mm-hmm. Why are you coming to this?
Mm-hmm.
What is it doing with your body, and how is it acting with your mind, and how are you with it, with other people, with, you know, the world around you? You know, what is good for you about this? Why are you here? You know? And, you know, so then the doctor becomes the person to have that conversation with, mm-hmm. and you can kind of fine tune what it is that you are needing from this. And so, you know, doctors have opportunities of education, like through groups. One that comes to mind, of course, being on the West Coast is MAPS. And that's, you know, just a place where you can kind of look at measurable study groups and right. what is the content like on a molecular content level, mm-hmm. and how do these things interact with different parts of our biochemistry. None of which is, you know, like I have an associate's of arts as a paralegal. Like, you know, I know how to read. But, you know, and I ask a lot of questions, you know, but I don't know that, you know, so I'm just saying, like, definitely do your own due diligence, like, you know, look into this stuff for yourself. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and maybe there's even a more refined or precise way to talk about these things from what I'm saying, but, you know, there's a nice way to look at it, to go in medicinally on some levels, like you can see why, because it is a way for our culture, I think, to find a comfortable room and space or whatever where they can, you know, or at least socially acceptable or whatever, a space where they can talk to someone and say, so what is this? So what am I doing? So why do I need this? So why do you need this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what are we talking about? Like, what is your intention here? What are you going to use this for? Other ways that people have gone about is like a religious approach, you know, kind of the same questions, but from a question of like, it's my deepest held belief is the basis and source of all of my actions, you know,
right.
like that kind of approach.
I think that, but, you know, I have a, you know, just interjecting about the religious approach mm-hmm. to these substances. I think one of the things that has really irked me about that conversation over the years, and it's something I've been thinking about and writing about for a really long time. I actually did project my senior year in college on entheogens and their religious connotations and the struggles that people have had to endure in this country to gain religious freedom for the use of psychedelics. And I think that it's very interesting in this country that we have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was in name created to protect the religious freedom of members of the Native American Church. It was written in reaction to a court case involving members of the Native American Church. And it has now been more or less hijacked, in my mind, to not really protect the religious freedom of small groups that are the minority and that are unusual, but to like strengthen the religious majority in this country. So a group like Hobby Lobby, for example, which is a corporation, is using the Religious Freedom Restoration Act as a smokescreen or protection for them to, you know, not provide some kind of health care for their employees. And meanwhile, people who are using these substances religiously have to go through this gauntlet where essentially the government gets to decide whether or not you're being sincere about your religious practices or whether you're just, you know, using as an excuse to get high. And from my perspective, I mean, I don't think anybody can really place judgment on the sincerity of your religious beliefs. Yeah. So that's my soapbox, I guess.
No, I feel it. Because it's interesting in the sense that we are in an age or an era or like a time, a moment at least, when obvious contradictions, you know, like things just seem so starkly contrasted, and you're given like the immediate sort of, I mean, what I think of when you're talking about the hobby thing, that story is, it's like in a moment to say, okay, but do you see this? Is this how you want to use this? Because it can be utilized this way,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's like, oh man, there's a reflection of that coming out in the real world in a practical way that is like, you're like, no, can we refine this a little bit?
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Can we get a little more specific about what we're talking about? And I think that's kind of what you started to do with the rest of your statement, is to kind of get into the fact or the idea, at least, that we have multivarious perspectives. We have many places from which our hearts beat, you know, many stances in which we feel passionately for or conservative about something. And whether you're like passionately, you know, putting everything into it or conserving it, like
mm-hmm.
whatever your passion is, that is something we have in common, is that we have a place of passion, that we have a thing that we love so much that we would just, you know, like spill over for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for me, some of this conversation also pulls into, like, in terms of having that meditation to put our collective imagination towards this public dialogue, because it's happening. Like, we're at a place where every day, like Hawaii has just said, like, hey, no discrimination based on whether or not someone is working in an industry that involves cannabis, also known as marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to keep using both words because where I come from, they mean the same thing, you know?
But, yeah. Oh, they definitely mean the same thing. I advocate for the use of cannabis as opposed to marijuana because of the history of the term marijuana being used as a way to sort of demonize the plant and associate it with brown people from the South, which was designed to make white people from the cities be afraid of it. And I also think that it's one way that we can sort of change the conversation subtly. And
yeah.
When I grew up with parents who were educators and who were always really adamant with me about not using like slang terms for my private parts and always that kind of thing. My parents are very scientific. They're religious people as well, but, you know, very in terms of that kind of stuff. So to me, using the term cannabis. Yeah. So
yeah.
To me, using the term cannabis is makes sense. It takes away the emotional baggage, and we're just talking about a plant.
Right. For me, use of the term cannabis is a flag to say, I understand. And I totally want to find a place of healing and disempowerment of whatever it was that threw a barb out and took claim over someone else's soul and purpose and nature, you know?
That's good.
And And likewise, marijuana is written in all the legislation.
It is.
And it's ridiculous for me not to be very clear that what I'm talking about is that. You know,
good
like
point.
I am talking about cannabis and marijuana.
Good
and
point.
I am meaning the same plant.
In the Michigan legislation, they actually spell the word with an H, which is really interesting.
Yeah. And in Canada, they spell it different too. Uh-huh. So, you know, what the fuck, man?
I've never met anybody who spells it with an H, but it's spelled with an H in the Michigan legislation. So, like, you know, like sometimes build like dispensaries and places will they'll put an H on it just because that's the way it is in the legislation.
Yes, well, that's because you want to be clear in your licensure, and you want to make sure organizationally that you've got your shit together. And if you've misspelled the purpose of your business, you may be thoroughly shut down, taxed, and fucked.
Well, I don't think that doesn't stop anything. We've had some pretty big raids in the state. People who are operating completely within the realm of the law, and mostly it's local law enforcement who decide they just don't like cannabis in their town and just come in and they take everything. And because of asset forfeiture, they don't, you know, they take all of your stuff and maybe take your kids off to CPS, but you don't get charged with anything. You just take all your stuff and you never see it again and your kids go away.
This is the result of, you know, possibly this seems to me like the result of that gap, the education to legalization, where we went from prohibition. I mean, just like DARE is an example, because this program came into my school and did this really weird, flashy, kind of psychedelic, honestly, concert/presentation that had the most like lights and
really?
People dancing. Yeah, it was
what year was this?
God, this had to be like 1990, maybe like 1991.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I just remember like Pepsi was a major sponsor and then
of
opened
course
up,
they were.
Yeah. And opened up like dispensaries all over our school.
Dispensaries.
Pepsi dispensing cans, you know, right. Little can dispensary things.
Yeah.
And then And I was like, what the fuck was that? And they were like, don't do drugs. I mean, listen, we'd
don't
had
do drugs except caffeine.
Right. And they we'd had DARE in school since I was in elementary school. I remember talking to my parents about it.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I was in elementary school in the 80s. So definitely the program was out there. My grandparents were major Reagan enthusiasts who had been Democrats and then literally were like, Reagan changed us. He's awesome. So
they really are Reagan Democrats. That's interesting. I thought it was a myth. But we're talking about Utah here, right?
Yeah. Oh my goodness gracious. I don't know if my family really, I don't know. Anyway, so so we went from just say no and pot is the gateway drug to nothing. Silence. So
right, because like DARE now they don't even mention cannabis on their website anymore. No. It's just like erased from the conversation.
It's gone. It's just dropped entirely from the conversation. And I know that in the cultures that have been pushing for legalization and decriminalization or, you know, something to the effect of just stay out of it for all these years. It's a plant. It grows. You know, we do what's right with it. And that's the end of the story. And, you know, if someone has a need for help, it may not be related to the plant, even if they're trying to use the plant to help and so on and so forth. And, you know, there's a public health issue type thing. But anyway, I'm kind of diverging again. To just like there's no information and wide swaths of the public as to what happened between prohibition and now. Mm-hmm. You know, there's and they kind of look at the political process and have so much kind of faith or belief or trust in what they've learned so far. I saw this in example during the Utah debate that was going on as we tried to push forward a couple of different ways of legalizing one that had like the whole plant considered, one that had extracts available only to pharmaceutical development companies.
Yay.
Yeah. So, you know, a couple of views there, I think. Anyway, but it was kind of expressed when this person said she had concern and she was one of the people who was speaking on behalf of a constituency. And she's like, I'm really concerned about how this is going to affect our communities and our families and our homes. And I'm really concerned that this went from being very bad for us and dangerous and criminal and addictive and something that will definitely, definitely lead to a gutter life of abuse and dismay to like medicine. You know, mm-hmm. She's like, uh-huh, mm-hmm. What? Now what now? Now what's that? And in the meantime, like the gap is not being filled in. It's kind of like, well, lady, you know, or you don't. And not really, you know, people.
But that, I think that's a really solid point. I mean, if I think about like the things that I know in terms of like the history of marijuana demonization, and you know, one of the big thing that cracked the nut for me was the book by Jack Herer, The Emperor Wears No Clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And
I haven't read that.
I mean, it's an older one. It's, you know, it's from the 90s, and I think I owned it back in, yeah, I don't know, 2003 or something like that for a while. But it's a really great book in terms of the entire history of cannabis, of how it has interacted with American culture and how it became demonized and all of this stuff. And then it talks about all the possible benefits of it. And it's somewhat outdated book by today's standards, I think, but it does really lay out that long history of the creation of the Controlled Substances Act and Harry Anslinger, and you know how there was all these unemployed guys who had been fighting, you know, sort of doing the sort of look rounding up alcohol during Prohibition, and suddenly they're all idle and need something to do, so they've come up with this new enemy. And I think that's something that's really missing from, you know, the average person who isn't interested in these things at all is not going to know any of that stuff. You're so right, and I hadn't really thought about that before. That you're
well, and
yeah, go for it.
So, like, I definitely know people who do not feel that they are racist. They feel as though anyone that they encounter on the street is just another person they encounter, and they don't feel as though they have reactions to them based on how they look. You know, whether or not that's true, I know people who would say that's the case, and so the minute that someone comes along and says, for example, that marijuana is a racist term, they actually kind of turn off the conversation because they're like, well, I'm not racist, so this is nothing for me to discuss.
Oh, yeah. And with the average person who used the term marijuana, I'd never bring up the racism thing at all. I only bring it up here because, you know, we're sort of in the club and everything.
So that's something. Well, and that's something to kind of point out, is that I think that's one of the kind of empathy generating conversations that you can have with someone.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe racist is kind of an inflammatory term, because someone who's really working to infuse their self-identity with something that does not identify as racist, you know, to have a self-identity that just works with the idea that, yeah, they see every person for who they are, mm-hmm. you know, like they approach them as an equal, whether or not they have a color. Well, that's kind of a weird way of putting it. I guess everyone would have a color, but
yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I hear you.
Sorry. But, you know, to just kind of say, well, let's talk about the history of the term, maybe is a way to put it. Because the apparentness of the connotation of racism will come out in that without having to immediately, put a label, I guess, kind of on it that has so much dialogue in our country.
Yes.
And you know, at the same time, I mean, if you feel like the right thing to do in that moment is to just right out say like, this is racist, and like, you know, if that's the message, then I mean, okay, whatever, it's your voice, your mouth, like whatever, you know, your conversation. But this is some of the kind of ground that I'm talking about. And you know, I guess part of it is like integration, intention, setting are all really, I think, kind of common themes in what I've read and experienced about people who have positive or neutral experiences, or even difficult experiences that they, in the end, were kind of glad they got through or went through. Mm. And partly because if you're going to have a difficult experience, like, you don't want to have it in the middle of the day at your high school,
right?
You know, or if you're going to have a difficult experience, wouldn't it be nice to know that you're in a safe place with whatever you feel safe with you, you know, like, you know, your parents, your partner, your doctor, you know, something to that effect. And
so let me ask you then, what do you think would be an effective means of communicating all of this history to, you know, the non-heads of the world?
Well, one thing I noticed when I was looking at Oregon's legalization process was that their tax revenues from the sales of recreational marijuana would be going to fund various state programs, including public education. So the way that works is, as the taxes are collected, they look every 35 days for the prior closed month, and they say, okay, taxes from recreational sales were this much. And then they put 40% of that into the state education fund. And mm-hmm. that's how it's written. And one thing I saw when I saw that was, well, what's the curriculum then? Like, obviously, they're funding education with funds from marijuana because they want to have marijuana education. And
is
you
that
know,
true?
You know, that's like my world.
that sounds like something I can do for a living.
I mean, if it's going into the state education fund, then it has to go into education, and that's public education. Uh-huh. And depending on your state, like in Oregon, public education kind of comes down to the district in terms of what the curriculum is that's taught. Mm-hmm. And then from there, curriculums, district curriculums go into schools for development. And so they're kind of sourcing from their own communities. And so this means that your teachers and administrators are the ones who are kind of talking and meeting and getting together and discussing what the curriculum will be for the next year. And there are also funds that are coming from the sales of recreational marijuana that are going to support this education. I don't think that they necessarily thought that what I just said was going to be the case, mm-hmm. that funds from marijuana would fund marijuana education. Mm-hmm. At the same time, in the presentation that I gave, I did show this one slide that had news from the Pacific Standard about how drug money is funding drug education. And this was published in March 12th, 2014. And it's in the slideshow that I sent you, like you mm-hmm. can, you know, share it again. It was just on the internet. I just did a search and it kind of pointed to the fact that most drug education that's happening in schools, because it is happening in schools, is focused towards public health and addiction prevention programs. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm 100% for harm reduction. I definitely want to see, you know, public health and people who have, abuse or addiction, come up in their life in any capacity, receiving support from their community, help that they need, you know, but to the extent that that is socially something they could be offered. At the same time, I found nothing in the public school system that seemed to indicate that there was a message going out to kids, families, or communities about how to now address this conversation. So right. that kind of, you know, goes back to the DARE went from don't do it, it's addictive and dangerous, to now like all the public education is still focused on abuse, addiction, prevention. That's not the story of right. cannabis or marijuana.
No.
Many, many, many people use cannabis and marijuana without having addiction, abuse, or those kind of issues.
Yep.
And I know that there is another narrative and a new story that's new to those of us who have been in the framework of prohibition. You know, it's like there's a story about how it works. And I think legalization is happening because that story has been shared in those avenues. And that might be one place to look to when developing curriculums. And that's something that I am advocating for, is that we should be developing curriculums that update drug education in public, in the public world. So, you know, one way to phrase it is kind of, it's kind of outdated because I don't know any school that uses a blackboard anymore, but like, you know, blackboards or iPods to your billboards, you know, mm-hmm. like what is the message that is being shared? What is the education that is being given to the public? What is the 10-second spot on a television, you know, or the banner ad on your webpage? Like, what is the message that can be shared broadly with the public, utilizing these public education funds that are available through revenues collected from the sales of marijuana, also known as cannabis? And how can that benefit this kind of cultural integration as, and also like the personal integration level? I saw a really troubling story about a child who at her school was being suspended because she was suspected of having her hands smell like marijuana. And I mean, I just welcome you to like, what if, first off, like they searched her, they found nothing. They found nothing in her locker, her backpack, etc. They found no, you know, her mother was like, she's a really good kid. There's no collaboration. Mm-hmm. And this was like, you know, this is like a story that's just like, are you kidding me? That was enough. Like some administrators like, well, you smell like weed, you're out. Wow. And that's a stigma, you yeah. know, that's a stigma. And now fast forward to the kids who are in a place where it's been illegal, it's been prohibition, but now hello, yesterday is my mom's medicine and she smokes it in her house.
Right.
And I smell like weed and I come into the classroom. And my teacher, who's been teaching at this school and is well respected for the last 30 years, is like, okay, red flag waving, you smell like weed, get back on the rails, you know? And it's like, wait, no, they moved the track. Hold on, they moved the track. Wait, when did they move the track? No, they didn't move the track. I've been teaching here for 30 years. And I know weed when I smell it. It's addictive, dangerous, and criminal.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That narrative really is something that needs to be built. That filling in that story from prohibition to now, that education is a service to the public, I think. And
so it seems to me that you're saying you're not just talking about drug education in schools or drug education for young people. You're talking about that we really need to sort of like re-educate the entire population of our country, especially the people who are not in the know.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty amazing thing. And I think you're totally right, but I don't think anybody else is talking about this. Not that I've heard.
Well, and I've heard, you know, like one person kind of whispered in my ear that there's someone in California who's working on a curriculum, but I haven't actually looked that person up yet. So I'll have to look in that, you know, and I believe that there has got to be some people who have put this into action already, because, you know, that's the way educators work.
Well,
and
I think it seems like what we need, what you're saying and what I'm envisioning would be sort of like Carl Sagan's cosmos of medicinal plants, or somebody, you get like Dennis McKenna and Chris Killam and somebody else to sort of get together and do a 6-part presentation on the National Geographic Channel about cannabis and the history of cannabis and talking, maybe introduce a little ayahuasca and mushrooms and peyote and really educate people about how plants help humanity.
That's one of the great lessons you can get from marijuana, is that your personal space with it, you know, like what is your safe use, your good use limit. But yeah, it's some kind of National Geographic or whatever, like some kind of, you know, widely held up message about it would be great.
Mm-hmm.
At least in terms of these situations, like I just sent you a link to that story about the high school student who was suspended in North Carolina.
Cool. We'll add that to the program notes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and this is something where it's like, you know, she, like her hands, her circumstance, I don't know that there was anyone in her house that gave any justification for that. It sounds like it was just completely bunk, you know? But in my mind, I thought about the child who's in a totally legalized, legitimate situation and encountering someone who's not there because it's not in their household. And it's been a very different story. And yeah, I don't know exactly the vehicle. I think the model of following the community to be able to build that message that fits with their community. And then, you know, the nature of using these funds is that the nation will kind of give some play into that in terms of like what the national, I guess, maybe standards or something will be. I mean, you know, there's already science standards and things that affect curriculums. There's no doubt that there's some degree of that. But states have control of the tax revenues and communities are interacting with their districts. And that's, you know, maybe not the model in your state, so double check it, but that's definitely the model in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And which I'm not from there. I've just been reading up on it because it's interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm following legalization. I really am an advocate for legalization. I think it's fine for states to take the approach that's best for their community, but I think they should definitely look at how their community benefits and wants this. And then just kind of, you know, go ahead and say like, hey, things changed. Like, you know, we got more information. Like mm-hmm. we saw more practical experience with this. Like mm-hmm. more people came out and said, this is my real actual experience with this. I didn't become a couch potato. I'm not like, you know, like
sometimes I do, but you know, it's situational. I find for me that I can usually do creative work pretty well in that state. Like if I, you know, want to like do an interview with somebody in that state, I'm usually pretty good to do that. Now, if I want to go back and edit a conversation to put it up on the internet, that sort of analytical kind of decision-making, usually it doesn't go so well for me.
Right. Yes. So I can't remember who said it, but it was write drunk and edit sober.
Right. You know, we're getting towards the end of our hour, but I would like to hear you, if this is information that you have, or you can provide, maybe sum up what the differences are in the states who currently have legal cannabis. What are the differences in the way that they've approached it, and which ones do you think are doing things right, and which ones do you think maybe aren't doing things so right?
I think my opinion is it's really early to tell who's doing it right, because everything is kind of experimental right now.
Okay.
One thing I noticed in Oregon when I was there is, because I did visit a dispensary there, and I did.
Yes.
Yeah. And I purchased marijuana there I was there. And I noticed that one distinction there is that medical and recreational are available through the same dispensaries, although at different counters.
Mm-hmm.
And in Seattle, that's very different. That was one of the things was, while this group that I went to in Seattle did have the license, they went through the process basically to occupy a license so that it couldn't be used because there were a limited number that were being put out there.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they had to have a different door if they were going to do recreational sales. So, you know, your medicinal alcohol is over here, your recreational is over there. Seattle makes it so that you have to have a different door. It's an entirely different dispensary. There's no question that this is medical over here and this is recreational over there. If you're going to go to Oregon, you're going to be able to walk into the same door and find different counters. But any of the bud tenders who are inside of an Oregon dispensary should be able to provide you with information, whether you are a medicinal or a recreational customer, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
However you're patronizing it, they should be able to give you information so that, you know, if you were a recreational patron and you were curious about medicinally, like you're thinking, actually, I kind of noticed that I use this to, you know, whenever I feel like my ankle is feeling that old injury, I smoke this weed. It's like, oh, well, maybe that's a thing to actually talk to your doctor about. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you are a medicinal patient.
Right.
And, you know, or, you know, mood affective type things. And if you go to Colorado, which I haven't been there and actually gone through that system myself yet. But, and I know it's not surprising because they legalized so long ago, but hey, one thing there is that they are more open on, edibles and, you know, Seattle, I guess would be too, and Seattle also has a delivery system in place. So if you're in the Seattle area and you're able to, have delivery to a residence, you can do that. But they're, you know, they have, I mean, you know, just basically like, I mean, look at Leafly. It works pretty well. Definitely check the state site. I mean, I always look at the state site and say, like, what am I getting into here? I guess Colorado was so, like, enthusiastic. I did call them on a story that I read right kind of early on when they were doing legalization and kind of verified. There was this, like, some website that came out with a story out of Colorado about dispensaries. I can't remember the exact detail, but I remember I called the state and was just like, is this really happening? And they were like, no, definitely not. Cause I was like about to get in my car and drive there. And they were just like, no, that's not real yet. I think it was kind of an early announcement on some news that was still yet to be just displayed about legalization. Mm-hmm. But, anyway, so that's, you know, in Oregon, you have to be a medicinal patron to be able to consume edibles, which is something that I learned.
And well, it's an interesting thing with the edibles. I mean, all of the really negative press that I've seen coming out of Colorado is all almost exclusively, you know, sort of real newbies eat too much edibles and lose their shit. And I think that that's honestly a legitimate concern. I mean, you have to know what you're doing when it comes to eating cannabis, because it's a real big difference in experience, and it comes on slow and it hits you real hard. It can, if depending on each, you know, each brownie or each batch of butter that you make is going to have a different potency. It's real hard to tell until you eat a few of them to really figure out what it's going to be like. And I don't think they're really for beginners.
I, you know, and that's something, there is a Good to Know Colorado website that I found kind of interesting to study, because it has kind of both frameworks, although the prohibition one kind of puts itself out there a little bit earlier in the presentation of the website. But it does say things like, maybe, you know, try a bite And right about the time that you think it's having no effect, 6 hours later, just be okay with that. Say like, okay, I had a bite and a day later, I felt like it had no effect. Mm-hmm. Today, I shall try 2 bites.
Yes.
And give that another full day or day and a half, you know, because it's the time when people say, oh, I thought it was having no effect, so I doubled up.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, no, it's terrible, you know. And the thing is like, okay, so for me, like edibles, you can feel like you start to feel it more in your whole body, maybe.
Right.
You know, it's something that takes on a more kind of visceral effect. Maybe that is something that would couch you, you know, put you in a state where you just want to kind of lay down and relax. Maybe it's something that makes you very active, like you feel very focused and want to jog. But do you remember where you live? I mean, you know, like you want to go jog for 5 miles, but then you turn around and you don't know where you are. You're like, wait, where am I? Yeah. You know, like that is, you know, not the same as the puff or two you had from a joint in college at that party one time. Or even if you used to smoke a joint a day, or even if you still smoke a joint a day, if you've never tried an edible, I think you're right. You know, suckers, you don't necessarily want to eat the whole thing, keep the wrapper, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, there's all kinds of different edibles. Myself, I'm very curious about the cannabis oil infused chocolate covered coffee beans because, oh, yummy. Man, it's like a triple hitter.
Sounds beautiful.
Like, you know, that I could go for that. Anyway, I'm like, what's the story on this?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I know. Like, no. But that's, yeah. So, you know, there's some of that, but again, these are the kinds of considerations that adults tend to give things, you know?
Yes.
Maybe not every 21-year-old, but I think it's a more adult conversation that we're having. Like adults tend to think about like, well, maybe I shouldn't just kind of jump all the way in. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason to have very candid, honest conversations. And I really liked, I've heard this before in a couple of conversations, but you and Matt Vogel brought this up on your podcast a couple of weeks ago, talking about Alison Gray, and she referenced what her response is. And Matt was talking about this in terms of his response. And I've used the same thing where it's like, whatever your child has asked you about, you know, first is the ground for them to be able to ask you the question.
Right.
And then is the place where you let them keep asking questions, but don't really necessarily offer up more than what they asked about.
Right.
You know, you don't want to lose them. Like, you don't want to lose your audience. Like, yep. They're listening to you. Oh, you've said too much. Oh, they're gone. You know?
Right. It's like, you can see when their eyes glaze over.
Yes. So, like, answer the question. And, you know, sometimes I'll go a little beyond the question and I'll get my kids like putting their hands up saying too much information. But that's, you know, we kind of talked about like sometimes that, you know, they'll let me know if they feel like I'm oversharing, but, you know, and let them kind of be still the ones to ask and be curious. And, you know, cause you want to have a good relationship with your kids, but you want to be honest and aware. You know, for me, it was just an awareness that my parents didn't have to know anything about what was being offered to me from elementary school up through high school. For me, it was just enough that, you know, either it wasn't offered or that I kind of knew I wanted to not get engaged with it at that time. Yes. Like I just, you know, and part of that was just my parents having said, I don't think you want to engage with that at this time. You know, maybe you want to be an adult, maybe you want to be a little older. And that's, you know, for my kids, I even said like, I don't think that I can stop you because your friends are the hands that are giving it to you because it's not my hand. Like, uh-huh. You know, I haven't offered this to you. So this is coming from some other source. And I recognize that you are out in the world a bit now. So, you know, let's be honest and real about this and, you know, and fill in some of the gap around this. And even in a legalized world, especially also in a legalized world, like this conversation becomes relevant.
Yes.
And it's been relevant. Like we've been having conversations about drugs in schools and in households my whole life.
Right.
So now what is the conversation? What is the legalized conversation? How do we help kids not have to endure the stigma of smelling like pot? You know, it's not, that's not guilt. If your grandpa lives with you and he's smoking it for his PTSD, you know,
or if your parents are farmers and it's shrimp time, it's unavoidable that everybody is going to stink real
bad. And you're
going
to have pot leaves on your socks.
Right.
You know, like, so there are definitely communities out there that may have some really awesome insight to offer on this conversation, who know how to have this conversation with their kids.
Yeah.
And so I would invite anyone who feels like really aware of a conversation that works or of a way to, you know, share about this to do so in a way that feels comfortable to them, you know, meeting their neighbors on their ground and meeting the legalization conversation on that ground in their communities. And just talk about, and, you know, and in the appropriate settings or whatever, like, you know, everyone has their own point of judgment, but like, discuss how it works. Talk about the message that is good for kids, that helps them find their own, you know, their own comfort zone, but also clearly communicates, like, you know, when you're 21, for me, that's just kind of, I have like this weird life where things come to me at like kind of a great moment. So mm-hmm. like 21, that was a great moment.
Sure.
You know, like the world just said, you know, this is a great age. Why don't you go ahead and try this now? And it was, you know, that was fine. It really helped me to kind of, relax a little bit into my life. And mm-hmm. at the same time, you know, now I can talk about it from that perspective too. I can say, this is what it was like to try this for the first time at 21. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I was a little more cautious naturally at that point. I was just like, okay, I will have a hit or two. I'm not going to like take the whole joint down at this point, you know, mm-hmm. like just having a little bit of a question about my own nature and how my nature meets with the nature of this experience. And being okay with something that is, just a kind of handshake and an introduction and a hello, mm-hmm. you know? But then at the same time, being willing to go, you know, further with the plant as I felt comfortable. Boy, yeah. Suddenly this feels like a strange kind of consent conversation, but anyway, so.
That's great. Yeah. And, we're way past the time. So want to say thank you so much for being on. This is a really great conversation. It was great to share the stage with you, and hopefully we'll be able to continue this conversation more in other venues.
Jonathan, thank you so much for making the Psychedelic Parenting website and all the work you do. And I just want to let you know that I really support that, and I appreciate you so much. And thanks for having me on today.
Thanks. Well, you have a wonderful day. Enjoy your time in sunny California.
All right.
Thank you so much.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.